Welcome to the Citizen of New Jerusalem podcast, Reviving Western Civilization.
Jesus was born and Jesus suffered in order to be God the dead man. Hey guys, this is Adam Kane, your host. Just quoting to you from Jonathan Fisk's new book, Echo, Unbroken Truth, worth repeating again. And you're about to get a real treat. I got to interview him for the second time on the show about his new book. And oh, it's just so good. It's just so full of meat. he takes a look at the essential parts of our Christian faith in a way that is really from a new angle, a different angle, using language that you haven't gotten used to, that hasn't been burned into the ruts of your brain and become just rote memory. Yep, he echoes the things that we should know, the things that we should be saying, the things that we should believe in a new way. And I want you to hear this interview with an eager heart. Unfortunately, because Skype is awful and untrustworthy, there's going to be some audio hassle to your ears as you listen. It's definitely going to hassle you as it did me as we were talking. I'm going to clean it up as best I can for you, but you'll still have to endure a bit of that. I beg you to endure it and to listen in and to enjoy this and to get Pastor Fisk's new book. And just show them your appreciation by sharing it on social media, share this episode, whatever you got to do. And I really appreciate your listenership. Guys, this is fun. It's great being your host. And I hope to continue to do this for many moons and to continue to get your feedback, which you can leave me at citizenofnewjerusalem.com. You can drop me a few pennies there at the donate page if you want to help me pay for hosting and the other things that go into this show. But even without that, I really appreciate your listenership and knowing that you're out there with me, thinking with me about what's best for the revival of good civilization in this world. Yep. So here's my interview with Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Hey, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Thanks for coming back to the Citizen of New Jerusalem podcast.
It's good to be back on, Adam.
Yes, you're my first repeat guest, and that makes me happy. Now, I want to hear about Echo. I want to talk to you about Echo, this new book that you've put out that is really marvelous. And the way you've written some of these sentences just absolutely peeled my eyelids back to see things in a new way. But first, just want to hear a little bit about where you're at in your ministry and in the projects you're working on. So what's on the table right now for Jonathan Fisk?
Right now, I've just recently landed in Rockford, Illinois, where I am soon to be installed as the senior pastor of a congregation here. And a lot of what I'm doing is trying to get that up and running. It's a whole new job, a big learning curve, and then trying to also get the technology on my side to continue my podcast. And I want to do some YouTube videos and other things as well to continue writing. But there's a lot of nuts and bolts when you move, and particularly if you're trying to launch and rebrand, you know, media. So that's most of what I'm doing. Raw still comes out once a week or so, just kind of restarted that. It's not as deep as it was. And Sharper Iron, you can still hear me every morning from 8 to 9 a.m. on KFUO Radio, KFUO.org. That show is definitely going.
Excellent. You definitely have your nose to the grindstone, like it says, I think, in Ecclesiastes. No, in Lamentations, let a man bear the burden in his youth. And I think you and I are about the same age. And if you're like me, you feel youth sort of slipping away a little bit there. So
it's fleeting. Yeah, it's fleeting.
Now's the time to do things. My daughter is 7.5 months old and hasn't yet really slept through the night once. So I'm feeling my age actually encroach at an increasing speed.
I bet you are.
But let me ask you about Echo. It's Echo, Unbroken Truth, worth repeating again. Just came out from Concordia Publishing House, and I was able to read most of it before this interview. And I want to ask the obvious question, I guess, the obvious interviewer question. Why this book? What did you see? What was going on in your field of vision that made this book necessary?
I think there's maybe two things going on. One is that the general strain of Protestant Christianity, or really even, I think you could lump Roman Catholics into this as well, the general strain of Americanized Christianity, no matter what denomination you're in, is slipping away from the basics, from the fundamentals, from what we believe that makes us Christians. And for various reasons, there's arguments that are made against it. It's too boring, it's too stodgy, whatever, what have you. But I see that happening, and I wanted to make a case, make an apology, I guess that you could say it that way, but really make a pitch for how valuable just the most elemental Christianity is. And then on that, as a Lutheran, I believe that we have retained a very succinct way of reminding ourselves about what that value is, what that truth is, in this thing we call the catechism. And I know that Roman Catholics also have a thing they call the catechism, and Calvinists also have a thing they call the catechism, and all of those have some divergencies in them, but they all probably contain the thing I'm talking about. And so, and for Lutherans, that's actually what we mean when we say the word catechism. We say the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, and the Lord's Prayer are the total summary of all Christian truth, the total summary of Christian teaching, the catechism, or the echo of Christianity. And so I'm trying to make the case that that centered reality is what makes us Christian, is worth believing, is worth understanding, is worth repeating, and that if we're going to see us have an impact in this very clear present darkness of our modern media age, the way to do that is to rediscover what we've always believed, as opposed to perhaps thinking we need to discover something new or go with the latest gimmick or trick or what have you. Yeah, that's about it.
Mm-hmm. It's a book about what we should know. It's not a book about something that we need to discover for the first time. I think what you're really good at, and what sort of gave you something of a platform over the past 8 years, is your ability to communicate things, I don't want to say in a fresh way because that's so cliche. It certainly is. You have a way of phrasing things that can catch people's attention. I have a number of quotes that I underlined in this book that I won't go over in detail, but I have to say, just to pinpoint it before I forget about it, the section about Jesus' ascension, the section about his ascension was so profound for me. I had to read it to my wife, who was very distracted, but I demanded her attention to hear what you were saying about the ascension. And it's funny because the book of Hebrews says these things clearly. Paul talks about unapproachable light in 1 Timothy 6, as you quote it. But just to have you talk about that Jesus went outside of creation, he went to dwell in the unapproachable light, like Paul says, and that he went to the imminent Trinity, that Jesus ascended to the very pinnacle.
As a human.
Yeah, as a human. He ascended to the excelsis, quote unquote, of highest heaven, and as a man for you. That golden Lutheran two-word phrase, for you. That this man, this human being who is God, is now in control at the center of all things, which is outside of creation. I mean, beyond heaven. And that was what really started to catch my attention with that section, is we're talking beyond heaven. Heaven is creation. It's a part of creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a realm for the dwelling of the higher beings, right?
The goal is to remind us what we should know or do know, but maybe have forgot exactly what it means. So often these are words we say every week in church, right? Like, he ascended into heaven. But we gloss over them, and it's not because we're bored per se, it's almost because we've forgotten to speak about them, or they haven't been spoken about in biblical ways for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, as a little tangent here, you mentioned those golden words for you being Lutheran words. No, they're not. They're Christian words. Jesus says them. That's where we get them. It's from the words of institution given and shed for you, for the forgiveness of sins. So we're just emphasizing what Jesus said. But that's the whole point. There are things that the early church emphasized about Christianity, which we maybe don't think of as being as central to Christianity. So yeah, we have, he was born of the Virgin Mary. We celebrate that every Christmas, right? So, oh yeah, okay, we remember this. We kind of understand it. Or Good Friday calls to mind his crucifixion. But Ascension Day, which actually is in our liturgical calendar, falls on a Thursday, it's part of the problem, is largely forgotten as a result of that. Most people don't attend it. Many churches don't even pay attention to it. So rediscovering how this is part of the New Testament gospel, right? The second article of the Apostles' Creed, that middle section about Jesus, is what the early church believed was important to know Jesus did for us. they didn't put in their feed 5,000 people, right? They didn't put in their walk on water, but they put in ascension. Why? Right? There's a reason for this. And part of it is what you were saying there about this returning mankind to the imminent presence of God, not returning, really taking it there for the first time. We could never actually go there before. When heaven, so far as where we go when we die, is in the presence of God, but not this one, right? It's kind of in the place of the angels. I don't know. The Bible actually doesn't say very much about what it means to rest with Jesus. But even the angels don't go into the hidden council of the triune majesty. And John is very clear about this. You know, no one has seen God, he says, but God, the only God, has made him known. It's just not something we're able to do. But Jesus now, as a man, has done this. And so by common union with him, through faith, but I would also argue through the Lord's Supper, we're also in that presence now as Christians. And this is the stunning marvel of being brought into communion, literally, with God himself. So yeah, that's another thing. I think the chapter on suffering is the same issue. You know, he suffered under Pontius Pilate. We just kind of like limit that to a few hours, but forgetting how much from the very moment that he could think about it, he was suffering. And he was seeing the world as a perfect man sees it. We don't even know what that's like. Right. As a perfect man who designed it, and now he's seeing it broken. We can't even fathom what this is like. He carried that all the time. And you don't hear him, at least in the scriptures, I imagine in real life, you don't hear him complaining about it either. But he did. He was a man of sorrows, Isaiah tells us. And this is his whole life long. And this is for you, right? He was doing this for you. So the book is really trying to do that. Take those ideas with everything, including the parts you think you know, the crucifixion, the incarnation, but go back to, say, the Ten Commandments, which I know you think you kind of know them, even if you can't say them, quote them from memory by number. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, I keep those things or whatever. My guess is you haven't thought about those nearly enough for quite a long time. They are stunning. They are such deep wisdom. And the Lord's Prayer, all the more, sort of a vacuous, feely-good thing for many of us. Man, is it deep. It's deep with actual biblical truth. Its connection to the Ten Commandments is profound. I don't know if you've gotten that far yet. It's a reflection or a refraction of the Ten Commandments through the cross of Jesus. It's beautiful stuff. And so trying to really awaken us to what we all know, but we all should probably know a little better than we do.
Right. And in my own context of evangelical churches, which have pushed away any sense of historical liturgy, we don't recite the creed. We don't recite the Lord's Prayer. We don't give much thought to the Ten Commandments, except maybe in Sunday school for little kids. And, you know, so for me, coming from a kind of an outside place to this book, it has even more of a shock to my system than I would imagine maybe for the average Lutheran or a Reformed Christian who experiences these things in worship each week. And I would actually try to characterize the book as you saying, let's meditate together. Let's actually plunge into the recesses of revelation over and over. Because what happens in church is that we begin to think we've said it all. The word is spent. I mean, God forbid we think it, but I think we think it. The word is spent. We need a sermon series on hotter sex or whatever. And, you know, these treasures that generations and centuries of the church never stopped returning to, suddenly we've become wiser than they and have gone on to better things. And really, and I think we've become fools, if I can speak so boldly.
Well, you're just quoting Luther. Luther's experience in the medieval issue, which even a faithful Roman Catholic who loves their Council of Trent has to admit that there were some things that needed to be cleaned up, and that's what Trent was about. Luther was dismayed to find not only how few people knew anything of Christianity, but were in church all the time or regularly. They didn't know the Lord's Prayer at all, but even how few priests knew or could preach on the Ten Commandments or the Lord's Prayer. And so his catechisms initially were taking a much more ancient form of book called a catechism and the same stuff, Ten Commandments, Creed, Lord's Prayer, but his catechisms take that and taught it to parents and then to pastors so that they could be things that we believe. It's the center of what we believe. Now, certainly there are, you know, in the non-creedal groups that are out there, those that say, I have no creed except for that I have no creed. And I'm going to be snarky about it because I think it is kind of silly. But, you know, amongst those groups, even they do want to, at least in theory, historically, believe what the Apostles' Creed does confess. They just don't want to be tied to something other than the Bible itself. So for that reason, you can still see these things, what the Ten Commandments say, what the Apostles' Creed says, and what the Lord's Prayer says, as being these tools it's not just about repeating them in worship. We do that so that we have them memorized. That's basically the point of that. It's a memorization tool for children and for adults that you can't not know these things if you say them every week in terms of being able to regurgitate them. But you need more than just rote repetition. You need faith to apprehend what these things are. And so the book is also advocating that these are not just things I got to know and then put on a shelf or the right answers for a test when I get to heaven or something silly like that. What they are is the summary of the Christian worldview. It's the processing power of Scripture at work in us. So I don't want you to go home and just think you have to stare at the Ten Commandments all day. I want you to be awakened to live with the Ten Commandments as your assumptions, to live with the creedal truth as your assumptions, right? To live assuming Jesus has ascended to the right hand of God and is running all creation right now toward an end that has your salvation in mind, right? And then no matter what you see, that's what he's doing right now. I want that to be your assumption, right? I want what the Lord's Prayer teaches you to ask God for, to be the things that you assume, that you desire to ask God for. Most people, when we're praying, we only pray for the daily bread. We only pray for the stuff of this life. Heal grandma, keep us safe on our travels, you know, give us good government, stuff like that. There's so much more to that prayer, to having the name of God be holy in our midst, and to knowing that I'm going to cause problems for you if I'm not careful, so I need to be led not into temptation, lest my own self harm my neighbor, whom I love, and I'd have to ask for even more forgiveness than I'm already asking for. So I want these things to become, what we assume. And while there certainly are real differences between the Lutheran confession and other denominations, and they have differences between themselves, and I don't think we should gloss those over, I do think that at the root, there is this central echo of Christianity, which all of us, all of our groups, are in danger of losing. As you mentioned, once you've lost it liturgically, what's to keep you from losing it intellectually? What's there to preserve you? Right? What's there to keep it there?
I think that reality...
I've got an answer for that, actually. Hold that thought. You ask, what's there to preserve it? And I think the only thing left, once you've gotten rid of any sense of the historical train tracks that the church has traveled, is the providence of having a good pastor who cares about the scriptures. But as soon as he retires or moves on, it's absolutely open question.
And if you're in a non-denomination setting, then where do you find the next one? It's not as though Lutherans just have this down and we all got, you know, no problem getting good pastors no matter what. And if that pastor can do a lot of damage, even if the liturgy is there. But in one sense, I guess providence is not a bad answer at all, and one we must rely on. But my point is that these truths are being lost to the whole of American Christianity. We're forgetting them, and we got to bring them back. Otherwise, we're just going to be swept aside. And while I actually think that these truths contain all Lutheran truth in them, and that everything Lutherans are saying is basically what these things are, and that's why, you know, I don't think it's such a big deal to be a Lutheran, nonetheless, I don't think that anything in the book, as I've written it, is something that's going to make you as a Calvinist or as a Baptist or as a Roman Catholic say, wow, I shouldn't have read that book. It didn't help me, you know, rediscover what I believe and think about believing it more. Right. There may be some place, a sentence here or there, where you're going to see my sacramental theology. I mean, sure, you're going to see that. But it's a call to arms. It's a call to arms. It's a call to wake up and to stop acting like this world's our friend, like this culture is just going to let us be. And I'm not talking about putting us in jail. I'm talking about deceiving us and stealing from us our legacy, our heritage as Christians.
Right. I think the devil does his work by, for one part, convincing us that we are too simple sometimes, or that the faith is too simple and that we've got to basically complicate things or even redirect things to get our minds on something else that'll reinvigorate us. And especially when it comes to youth ministry and young people, I think there's a general lack of faith that what is in the Word of God will be sufficient to disciple and train them and to keep them in the faith as they grow into adulthood. And I think your book, while it's not necessarily aimed at youth, would be perfect for young people. Would be perfect, because it really is a way of speaking the old truths in a way that's going to capture the imagination. And like I said, I think it's a call to meditation. And before,
yeah, it's really intentionally not boring, because what we believe is intentionally not boring, and we managed to make it boring by talking about it in certain ways. And I don't know what the cause of that is. It's like our eyes have glossed over to the depth of these things. So, and we haven't really gone into this really directly here in the podcast, but you know, every piece of what we've been talking about in the book, I try to give it some new language to reimagine, or not reimagine, but to understand what really is going on in that confessed thing. So as an example, the forgiveness of sins confessed in the third article of the Creed. What is that? What does that mean? I mean, it's language we use all the time. And yeah, sure, I kind of know it means I'm supposed to like let sins be okay or something with my neighbor if they're bad to me and like let it go and all. But it's not really not what we're confessing. And it's so much deeper and so much more violent than that. You know, that the word forgiveness in the New Testament is the same word as divorce. It's the exact same word. There's no difference. It has two meanings. Because to divorce and to forgive mean to send away, literally. It's just to send something away. And whether I'm sending away my wife or whether God's sending away my sin, it is a radical kind of thing. So what is happening in the forgiveness of sins? We're being divorced from our, well, sin, another word that is a bit too fluid now, right? Our evil, divorced from our evil. Those things are being ripped out of us by God's work in Jesus on the cross. And so, again, to take these things that we've managed to kind of humdrummy bore ourselves with, or think we know oh so well, or think it's just the stuff we teach little kids, and now we've grown up out of it, and say, wait a minute, this is phenomenal. This is phenomenal stuff. This is the mythology wishes it could be this interesting. Right. The fact that we've made it boring or are bored with it is a stunning testimony to our own ignorance and our own curved in on ourselvesness. But there's no reason we have to stay that way. And there's no reason that the word rightly translated, and that's in some ways maybe what this book is trying to do, is translate old jargon by which we confess and rightly confess our dogma as Christians, our truth as Christians, to translate that into modern American speak. American, if I can say that. And you mentioned earlier that seems to be, where I struck a nerve with Worldview Everlasting, and there's something to that. I don't know what that means, but language is constantly shifting and changing under our feet, and the media age has exacerbated that. It's made it worse. And so some words have new meanings. Some are no longer being used at all. And if we don't find ways to restate or echo, right, to reconfess what's been said before, and we just instead repristinate, right, rather than echoing it with understanding, just repeat it kind of mindlessly. Well, if I don't understand what I'm saying, I can't really expect anyone to want to join me, can I? if the mission of the church is going to falter because we're not actually saying anything, we're just shouting noise into the darkness. And what we need to do is believe, teach, and confess. That means understand. To use Paul's language here again, have our minds renewed, and to use his language again, by the pattern of sound words, and coming back to that Pentecostal truth, which is not rolling around making noise and no one understanding what I'm saying, but saying the classic thing that Jesus is risen from the dead in ways that everybody in the world can hear it. And even if they think I'm drunk for saying it, they understand what I said.
And I think that you look at the New Testament, you look at where Jesus says, "He who keeps my word," that word in Greek, the keeps, is related to the word treasuring. There's this connotation of treasuring what we have in Christianity and in the Word of God, such that you would, if you had a treasure, you would go to it and you would just want to look at it. You would want to ponder it. You would want to think about it. And we do have treasures in our lives. We do have, every one of us has things that we love to ponder and look at and think about all the time. And I think part of what detaches our minds from the freshness and the goodness and the depth of what's here in the Ten Commandments, in the Creed, in the Lord's Prayer, is that we don't see why it's a treasure. And that really is the job of a book like this, is to remind you and say, hey, stupid, knock, knock, knock. This is a treasure. This is the treasure. This is the thing that actually outshines all other things, and which when you see it for what it is, you'll want to pass it on.
Yeah, and that's the goal. That's the goal of the book. And so I'm glad you've enjoyed it so far, because it's that's what it's trying to do, is kind of stir you up a little bit and say, man, I hadn't thought about that for a while. And then hopefully that gets it down a little deeper inside of you. And again, it becomes an assumption. It becomes part of your worldview that you build all your other thinking on top of these things. You don't just sit there and stare at the Ten Commandments, but you build your thinking about other things in the world on what those Ten Commandments say, right? So that you want to make abortion unthinkable, we got to make murder unthinkable, that kind of thing, right? You want to have a battle for marriage, then we got to make monogamous love of family is something that we desire and that we teach our children as a valuable thing. We've got to see procreation to be a valuable thing again, right? As opposed to sort of maybe as an accessory to life, those kinds of things.
Right. But what you really did well with the Ten Commandments, though, is to not just state the Ten Commandments as the negatives that they are. Have no other God before me. Do not murder. Do not, do not, do not. You actually went underneath them to state the implicit that there's a positive underneath each one of these. That's the whole point of that section of the book, is that God has a name and that he gave you a body. And it's such a different way of stating the principle underneath these Ten Commandments. It just captured so well the heart of God in having them be at the forefront of our minds, like it says in Deuteronomy 6, always before our eyes, between our eyes, and always being repeated and remembered and sought after, I would think, even sought after to see what's really underneath all of it.
And I got a hat tip Luther for that initial insight. That's what he does in his small catechism, is he says we should fear and love God so that we do not do certain things, but that we do other things. And I try to take that, you know, a step further. I took the handoff from him, and I'm pushing it even further, not only to the do these good things, but what do we know about being creation because these are good things? Because you're supposed to do the good thing of calling on God's name and prayer and praise and giving thanks to him, what does that tell you about God? It tells you that he has this name, right? And that this name has been given to you. And this makes him not like other gods in some ways, and that it's a personal reality. And that to know this name now that it's been given to you, you have to have the third commandment, which is that he speaks it to you. And it's not something you find by just staring at a wall, you know, sitting in the corner meditating. But instead, words have to come to you. So now we know God doesn't just have a name, but he talks, you know? And that's why we remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy by gathering around the word, which is being taught to us, as opposed to despising preaching in God's word. So it all hangs together. And as you get to the end of the book, I think you'll see that the picture is growing. And by the time you're at the back end, there's a total, it's a diagram, but it's a total representation of our life in Christ while we wait for his return as fallen creatures. And it's wonderful, because it's not my picture. Right. It's the Ten Commandments, the Creed, and the Lord's Prayer. But in that picture, you can see how it's more than just a list. It's more than just a set of ideas. It is a total package worldview by which you, listener, you will stand against the evil one in this present day, and you will stand on the last day and hear the words good and faithful servant said to you, because that is your Christian faith. It's a powerful, powerful thing.
I encourage everybody to get a copy of Echo, Unbroken Truth, worth repeating again. And really, take the time with it. Maybe do a chapter per night or something like that, and meditate as you go to sleep, or meditate in the morning over your Lucky Charms, whatever you got going on there. I'm telling you, it's going to be worth it, and reinvigorate some of your thinking about the things that we always have to be echoing to each other. Thanks, Jonathan Fisk, for joining me on The Citizen of New Jerusalem once again.
I appreciate your time, Adam. Thank you very much.